It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
They thought they were going to be doing any number of things involved with getting this giant manufacturing operation up and running. They thought they were on the front lines of bringing manufacturing back to Wisconsin and that it was going to be this great project.
And they end up watching Netflix in a 60s office building in Milwaukee that Foxconn had purchased.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes.
You know, if you take a step back and you think about some of the stuff that has driven Trumpism and its political appeal and some of the ways that political ideology and commitments between the coalitions have shifted, there's interesting things happening around economics, and they're happening around essentially the right trying to walk away from a certain kind of free market neoliberal consensus that has dominated the right, dominated both parties, but the left kind of peeled away from it, I think, earlier and more decisively. And now we're in this kind of post-neoliberal world where the old consensus about low inflation, tight monetary policy, big tax cuts, deregulation would lead to broadly shared prosperity and also peace and democracy across the world through globalization and global trade. And like that has not worked out at all. The recognition that that has not worked out, I think, has increasingly dawned on both political coalitions. And there's an effort to think about what the post-consensus ideology looks like. And one place that you see a lot of focus is on manufacturing, right? I mean, the old consensus idea was like, sorry, manufacturers of America, manufacturing is not going to really live in the new globalized world because it's cheaper to do other places. Those jobs will go to Mexico or they'll go to China. And you're going to, you know, to use the cliche, you're going to learn to code. And it turned out like, well, it's not awesome for Kenosha, Wisconsin to trade away car factories that are unionized good jobs for a big Amazon warehouse that are not unionized and pay half or a third of the wages. That's literally what's happened in Kenosha, by the way, which lost car manufacturing and it was replaced by an Amazon warehouse. And this has happened all over the place. And so you've seen this kind of effort to think about, okay, well, what if we sort of reject the neoliberal consensus, whether from the left or the right, which is that, you know, free trade, open markets, you know, the dollar is going to find where it's best used by corporations across the world. And we instead think about, like, what would industrial policy look like? What would it look like for the government to step in to try to actively support and craft good-paying jobs in fields like manufacturing across the country? And here's where today's story comes in. Because, you know, there's lots of reasons and there are critiques, and many of these critiques actually originating on the ideological right, particularly in public choice theory, of the ways in which industrial policy, that is, government taking an active role in attempting to sort of seed different kinds of industries in a place, can go really awry and be super corrupt. Now, that doesn't mean it always is that way, and there's lots of incredible examples in American history of very, very far-sighted industrial policy that's created tremendous benefits. Today's story is a story of what appears to be like one of the biggest cons slash policy disasters anywhere in the country in the last 5 years. It got a ton of attention at the time, and the idea was that Scott Walker in Wisconsin was going to invite the Chinese factory Foxconn into Wisconsin. I mean, talk about, you know, man bites dog, right? Instead of U.S. shipping jobs to China, a Chinese manufacturer is going to come to the U.S. Like, whoa, crazy upside down world. We're past the neoliberal consensus. We're out into the stratosphere. We're orbiting around some new ideological center in which we're bringing manufacturing jobs back to America. This was touted by Donald Trump. It was touted by Scott Walker. It was a whole big deal. And what happened? Well, today's guest is going to tell us. His name is Josh Jezza. He's investigations editor and feature writer at The Verge, covering technology, business, and climate change. Got an incredible piece out, investigative piece about what exactly went down with the whole Foxconn thing in Wisconsin. Let's start with this. What is Foxconn? Tell us about Foxconn.
So Foxconn is a Taiwanese company that does most of its manufacturing in China, in mainland China. It started in the 70s when Foxconn's founder, Terry Guo, started making plastic dials for TVs and is now the largest electronics manufacturer in the world. It makes the iPhone, it makes a lot of stuff for Apple, it makes Xbox, PlayStation, Dell, Hewlett-Packard, Amazon are all big customers. It owns a bunch of brands like Sharp and Belkin, and just manufactures a ton of consumer electronics, but is mostly behind the scenes. Consumers don't really interact with Foxconn.
Right. Like as a brand, we don't think of it. We think of the iPhone in our hands right. As an Apple product. So the weird thing about it is it's an enormous, enormous behemoth that is kind of invisible to us because, you know, it's making iPhones and then we buy the iPhone from Apple and we, you know, holding our hand, think of it an Apple product, but it's in some ways it's a Foxconn product. Like they made it. They actually physically made the device.
Yeah, and they do that in these enormous kind of factory towns in China, you know, 300,000 employees where they live in dormitories. Foxconn first came to many consumers' attention in 2010 when there was a string of suicides in these factories. But otherwise in general, it just makes the things that other companies put their brands on.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the conditions. I mean, I think a lot of it is in Shenzhen, right, which is the sort of area in China right near Hong Kong and Taiwan where, like, they first kind of opened up the economy the earliest as a kind of experiment, right, under Deng Xiaoping, and is where a lot of these sort of mega factories are.
Right, and Foxconn is one of the first companies to come in and start operating there. It relies heavily on relatively low-wage labor, workers coming in from rural towns, and they live in these giant dormitories and work long hours. It's difficult manual labor. It can be a depressing environment. I mean, they are relatively good jobs if you're coming from a rural community, but also it can be quite a dismal experience. And so in 2010, you had workers that were jumping off the roofs of dormitories. It caused a scandal. Foxconn's solution was to put up nets, suicide nets under the dormitories. But the thing to know about Foxconn and why the idea of it coming to Wisconsin was always a little far-fetched is that it relies on large amounts of manual labor. And so you can see why that would be appealing to someone like Walker who wants to bring back manufacturing. You might imagine that it would create the 13,000 jobs that Foxconn was promising. But economically, it doesn't really make sense. Foxconn is even looking to leave China, operate in other places like Vietnam and India, because the cost of labor in China has become too expensive. The profit margins for electronics manufacturing are incredibly thin, you know, single-digit percentage points, as opposed to a company like Apple, where you're talking 40% profit margin because it owns the intellectual property.
Right. I mean, just to be clear here, right? Like this, we talk about the value chain, and what tends to happen is, you know, the places with the absolute lowest, cheapest labor make the stuff that's lowest in the value chain with the thinnest margins, where they pay shockingly little, right? Like socks, for instance, which, you know, are made in Bangladesh, for instance. And then as economies grow and get richer, wages go up, you know, places tend to move up the value chain. We've seen, for instance, like apparel manufacturing, which is sort of at the bottom of the value chain, really moving out of places like China and gone sort of searching for cheaper, ever cheaper labor. And what you're saying now is that, like, that's the same thing's happening at electronics, which is further up the value chain, more sophisticated, more complex thing to make than, say, a pair of socks, but with very thin margins. And even Foxconn now is like looking for places other than China because China's economic growth is such that wages there have come up enough such that it's tight for them to still turn a profit.
That's right. That's right. And so you have them, you know, looking at Vietnam, looking at India, Malaysia, various other places where they might be able to get that low cost labor that you need to manufacture these devices.
So you've got a problem right off the bat, right? Like, if they're a company that's first of all, they've got these huge dormitories, centralized labor. I've read stories about how, like, there's no worker power. And, like, there's this famous story about how, like, Apple wanted to change the glass on – is this right that they wanted to change the glass on a screen at the last minute and, like, Foxconn – right before a release of the device, and Foxconn just made people work in, like, crazy shifts at the last minute to do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of the reason why Foxconn has – grown as much as it has, is its proposition is that it can make lots of things with a great deal of detail at very short notice. So preceding any sort of Apple product launch, you have Foxconn staff up massively. People work long, long hours manufacturing enough new iPhones to meet that surge in demand that follows a new Apple announcement.
But part of what we're getting at there is, like, what they're doing is a product of essentially kind of authoritarian control over their labor force, right? Like, you can make people work these crazy shifts. They work in dormitories and company towns. B, scale, right? 300,000 people working in one factory. And then C, just like the wage conditions such that you can, you know, pay people very little to extract these margins. And when you add all that up, you think to yourself, like, why would that work in Wisconsin?
Right, right. And you can see it even in 2017, you know, the year this project was announced, Foxconn was using student labor, where you had students who were told that to complete their studies, they had to intern at Foxconn, and that internship was manufacturing iPhones. So Foxconn is always trying to find a way to eke out a profit on these very slim margins, and nothing about Wisconsin would make that feasible.
How does this deal come about? Like, what happens that Foxconn comes to Wisconsin? Who approaches who?
This happened right after Trump took office, and Guo starts talking in the press about building a giant factory in the U.S. And he does this a lot. He will frequently propose a big factory that then doesn't appear or falls short of initial promises. But the Trump administration really ran with it, arranged a meeting between Guo and Walker, and then Walker really pursued the deal aggressively, offering around $3 billion in subsidies. That number, when you factored in local incentives, came to about $4.8 billion. It was part of this kind of beauty pageant between several states, each offering larger and larger subsidy packages for Foxconn, and Wisconsin won. Sort of famously, notoriously, Walker signed the deal on a single sheet of stationery during a visit to Wisconsin from Guo and a Foxconn delegation. And sort of during that about week-long visit, exactly what Foxconn was promising to build and how much Wisconsin was going to pay it kept changing. The factory nearly doubled in size. The subsidy package doubled in size. There was no real analysis of whether what Foxconn was proposing to do was commercially viable, but Walker really, really wanted this victory.
You know, Amazon did the beauty pageant, right? Where they made this big deal, like, here's the competition to get Woo Amazon. It was like this gross thing of watching all these states sort of debase themselves, be like, well, we will build you a football stadium, and, like, we will build you a subway that only Amazon people could ride and none of our people can ride, and yada, yada, yada. Does Guo basically formally say, like, who wants American Foxconn, or he's just sort of float it that creates this kind of bidding between different states?
Yeah, it is a bit confusing. There were a couple states in the running. I believe Pennsylvania was also in the running for a bit. But Trump and Guo both say that Wisconsin was always a favorite. In the response to this story, Guo issued a statement saying Foxconn had never really considered Wisconsin until Trump said it should go there.
Oh, did Trump say to go there?
That was what Guo said, and that's what Trump has said. Trump said that he got the idea actually while flying over Wisconsin with Reince Priebus, also a Wisconsin Republican who was his chief of staff at the time, and saw all this open space and said we should build a big factory there.
Let me just sort of state the subtext here. It seems to me like this whole thing was essentially a PR move by Guo from the beginning. Wisconsin's a key battleground state. It was one of the three states that Trump carried extremely narrowly to propel into the White House. There's a Republican governor. At that time, the Republican Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and the chief of staff in the White House, formerly the RNC, Reince Priebus, are all from Wisconsin. And here's a big, like, Donald Trump is your president. Donald Trump ran on bidding back manufacturing, making America great again. And now here's the big announcement that the Chinese are going to build a big factory in Wisconsin. You know, Guo knew what he was doing from a PR perspective.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, to get Foxconn side of this. Trump was threatening a trade war that would have really devastated Foxconn. So he had reason to get in Trump's good graces. And to that extent, it succeeded. He's been a regular visitor of the White House since this deal was announced.
Oh, so he's right. So he's worried about the trade war that Trump is threatening. This is a way to basically be like to buddy up to him and help a key ally in a key state that Trump needs by making this big announcement that is going to redound to the political effect of both Scott Walker and Donald Trump.
Right, right. That seems like the likeliest explanation for how all of this came about.
So what's the okay? So $3 billion in subsidies is a crazy amount. I mean, what is the actual package that Walker is offering, and what is the agreement that they sign that's going to come about from it?
The $3 billion number is part subsidies for Foxconn's capital investment, part for its payroll, and Foxconn gets these payments, and they would likely be payment. They're tax subsidies, but given the way Wisconsin taxes manufacturing, they would likely be made into just direct payments to Foxconn when it hits certain employment thresholds. So, you know, 260, I believe, was the first one, and then 520 people at the end of last year. And then it scales up and up and up until Foxconn hits 13,000 people by 2022.
So there's supposed to be this kind of ladder where as they employ people, they get the subsidies?
That's right. Yeah. So they defended the deal because it came under criticism for being just astronomical and way out of line with anything that Wisconsin or other states have promised, that it was performance-based, that Foxconn only gets subsidies when it meets certain hiring thresholds. It's not exactly right because the state and local governments were also spending lots of money developing the infrastructure Foxconn was supposed to need and acquiring all this land for this giant factory. But the subsidy payments were pegged to certain hiring quotas.
So there's two channels of money they're spending. They're spending money to acquire the land and create the infrastructure for a big factory. And then they're actually just paying, like spending like essentially like per job subsidy payments.
That's right. Yeah. Foxconn had said, we want to do this, but you need to cover the difference in operating costs between operating in Wisconsin and China.
And that's
so they come
difference.
Up with this number. It's a very big difference. Yeah, it comes out to being somewhere between $200,000 to $1 million per job.
Per job!
That's right.
I mean, $1 million per job is you could hire someone for $70,000 a year for 12 years just directly.
That's right.
And not give it to Foxconn, right?
Yeah, it is a very roundabout way of creating middle-class jobs in Wisconsin.
All right, so when do they sign this with the big announcement?
So yeah, it happens really fast. The summer of 2017, Grove visits Walker. He signs the sheet of paper. By the end of the year, they'd signed this deal. They passed an act through the assembly offering all kinds of other, you know, environmental exemptions, sort of a special judicial track for Foxconn-related lawsuits, all this stuff. By November, the deal is set, and Foxconn is supposed to start doing stuff. The groundbreaking happens, you know, a little less than a year later. Guo flies back in, Trump comes in, Walker, Ryan, everyone kind of grabs a golden shovel and breaks ground on this factory that Trump says is the eighth wonder of the world.
So 2018, you've got the groundbreaking with the golden shovel, and you've got Paul Ryan, Trump, Walker, and Guo, like, again, just transparently a political PR messaging push. And Walker's running for re-election this year, right? Like, for that year.
Right, and this becomes really wrapped up in his re-election campaign. He campaigns on it. He talks about the Foxconn bonus, this multi-generational transformative deal that is going to bring back manufacturing to Wisconsin, bring back manufacturing and also become kind of a high-tech Silicon Valley campus that he called Wisconn Valley with two N's.
There's a lot of criticism for the jump, obviously, because, you know, the dollar figure attached to the jobs is crazy. So then what happens?
Walker loses, and it had sort of emerged before, even before Walker's loss, that the company did not really have a plan for what to do in Wisconsin. You know, employees I spoke to talk about being told to figure out something for Foxconn to make in Wisconsin. The big push sort of toward the end of 2018 is just hiring the 260 people they need to get subsidies. No one knows what these people are supposed to do. And by the end of the year, they're just sitting around in this 1960s office building Foxconn has bought as its headquarters in Milwaukee. watching Netflix, playing on their phones, feeling quite dispirited about the eighth wonder of the world. And so by the time Walker loses, it's clear that the project has gone off track, and it just accelerates after that. Foxconn leadership starts to panic that Tony Evers wins the election, and he's been a critic of the deal, and now they have the prospect of a less friendly administration, and they have just nothing to show for their progress. This year-end letter touts, you know, how much dirt they've moved. They've built one building that's just sort of a warehouse that is empty. They failed to hire enough people to get the subsidies. They cut their budgets and start looking for some way to make money from this increasingly doomed-seeming project.
Wait, so in 2018, they're supposed to hire 260 people by the end of the year to get the subsidies. And they do or don't hire that many people?
They don't. They try. They have all these hiring events that, you know, they're sort of, they've always called them speed dating kind of things, where they have... They come to like a big event space. People come in. They offer people jobs on the spot. You know, give them a day to accept, but they fail to meet that goal. An audit found that they managed to hire, I think it was 113 people at the end of the year.
Part of the problem is like, what are they hiring them for?
That's exactly the problem. And so you have recruiters who.
You know, I mean, they're hiring them for it. They're hiring them to get the check written by the government. Like, this is like, I mean, again, this is where we're in the part of like, we're in the sort of most kind of free market Milton Friedman critique of why industrial policy doesn't work. Cause this is like the worst version of it, right? Like, they have signed a contract that's going to give them a government subsidy per worker. They have become totally detached from any actual internal economic logic of a thing they want to make that will be profitable. Ergo, the goal is to just hire people for the sake of hiring.
That's right. And a sort of weirdness of the contract is that you only count the people at the very end of the year. So there's this rush to hire enough people as late as possible so you don't have to pay them that much, but no real plan for what to do with them. And you know, the recruiters would have to tell people, they would say, you know, I'm in sales, but what am I selling? And they're like, well, I hope you're comfortable with ambiguity because we have no idea. And sort of in 2018, there was so much excitement around the project and the return of manufacturing that people still took the jobs. And you know, they hope, you know, maybe it's a, they're just moving so fast, they'll figure it out. And then by early 2019, it was clear that they very much were not figuring it out.
So you talked to some of these people that took the jobs.
Yeah. Everyone was, I mean, everyone had really high hopes for this.
What were these people's backgrounds? What did they think they were going to be doing?
A variety of backgrounds. A lot of them came from just various other kind of Wisconsin local businesses. A lot of veterans. Foxconn made a big deal about hiring lots of veterans. And they thought they were going to be doing any number of things involved with getting this giant manufacturing operation up and running. They thought they were on the front lines of bringing manufacturing back to Wisconsin and that it was going to be this great project.
And they end up watching Netflix in a 60s office building in Milwaukee that Foxconn had purchased.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of them did. I talked to someone who watched the entirety of Game of Thrones. But a lot of them sort of kept trying to make it work. And this is where it gets quite sad, is that they really wanted it to work. And they gave Foxconn a lot of the benefit of the doubt that it was just figuring things out. And so they would keep, someone would float an idea and they would really run with it. And then it would get vetoed by Foxconn management for, you know, they don't want to spend money on this thing.
What was the thing supposed to be? What was the fact? What was Foxconn? It was all, it seems to me, like never quite nailed down. Like there was all these like drawings of stuff and there's going to be this big technology hub and whatever. But like what they were going to make, was that ever like determined?
So this is what has become kind of the crux of the contract dispute that has been happening between the state and Foxconn, is that Foxconn was very explicit about what it was going to make. It was going to make a generation 10.5 LCD fabrication facility, which makes large screen TVs. It would have been the first one outside of Asia, a huge 20 million square foot facility. The problem was that, well, there were several problems, but one problem was that there was a foreseeable glut of LCDs coming when they signed the deal. And the other is that Foxconn is able to make these things by working very closely with its suppliers and crucially Corning manufactures the glass on site because the panels for this sort of factory are too big to ship. And so without Corning and with the glut and with the higher labor costs, Foxconn figures out pretty quickly it can't actually do this. And so it changes the type of factory. And this had actually happened sort of days before the groundbreaking to a much smaller factory called a Gen 6 LCD factory where you can ship the glass in from elsewhere. But, you know, this sort of many of the same problems persist with that type of factory. And so throughout the last several years, Foxconn has said, you know, we're building this Gen 6 LCD factory. We're still going to have 13,000 jobs somehow. They haven't built a Gen 6 factory either. They've built a building that would be the smallest Gen 6 factory in the world, and it's permitted for storage.
Are you serious?
Yes. So in September, they took out a permit to use the part of the factory that would have made LCDs for storage. They haven't ordered any of the equipment they would need to make LCDs. So Foxconn has continued to say that they're building this smaller type of LCD factory, which they are also not building, but even if they were building it, it would be 1/20th the size of this mega factory they had promised to build.
1/20th?
1/20th, yeah.
We'll be back after this quick break.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
So, I mean, it's not happening. Like, the whole thing, I mean, was it ever going to happen? It just seems to me like it was a con from the beginning.
I don't think it was ever going to happen. I think some of this, I've always been kind of baffled by what was going on inside Foxconn. And what I've figured out is that Foxconn has this sort of peculiarly distributed corporate structure. You know, it's a huge company, it's a huge conglomerate that's made up of all these different business units that all operate quasi-independently. They're responsible for their own profitability. And so you have Guo promising to build this giant thing. That promise brings certain advantages to Foxconn as it's facing a trade war. But then when the business units that would actually manufacture the LCDs get involved, they look at it and say, this doesn't make any sense. For all the reasons critics pointed out, it doesn't make any sense. And they just start dragging their feet. And so you get this situation where Foxconn as an institution is sort of unwillingly in Wisconsin and needs to find a way to cut its losses.
So what's the contract situation right now?
So for more than a year and a half, the state has been telling Foxconn it has to revise this contract. It's out of compliance. It's not building the thing that is in the contract. Initially, this was Foxconn's idea to revise the contract. But then revising the contract requires Foxconn to say what its new plan is. And not having a plan, it's refused to do so. And so they've just sort of gone around and around with the state saying, we're open to revising the contract. Please tell us what you're doing. And Foxconn saying, no, we're still in compliance with the contract, or just sort of not responding. So they entered into a settlement agreement this summer to revise the contract. It ended without a deal. And so they're just at an impasse. You know, there was a sense among employees that Foxconn's waiting to see how the election goes before deciding what to do. Reading between the lines of Guo's statement after the story, you get that. He talks about how good it's been working with the Trump administration, but not, this was before the election, not talking about the administration in general.
So, but how much money, like basically, how is this going to settle?
It's really unclear. The state has spent a lot of money. Foxconn has also spent some money. It has a lot of land in Wisconsin. It has a lot of empty buildings. It is never going to employ 13,000 people. It seems highly unlikely it's ever going to hit the thresholds it would need to get subsidies from the state. And the state, you know, has denied its subsidies because it hasn't built the LCD factory. And so it's unclear to me how this ends. It's possible Foxconn stays and runs some sort of small manufacturing operation employing, you know, a few hundred people, and that's its U.S. presence, and it just takes a pass on the subsidies. Maybe it sits down and revises the contract, or maybe it just leaves. It's contractually obligated to keep paying Mount Pleasant, this small town where the factory was supposed to be, as if it had built the factory that it said it would. But this is a town of 30,000 people. It has taken out hundreds of millions of dollars in debt to buy the land for Foxconn.
The town has?
The town has, yeah.
The town took the debt?
The town had its own subsidy package.
Oh, my God.
So it had initially promised, $800 million
what?
As part of this deal. Its credit was downgraded because it took on so much debt. It seems unlikely to me that Foxconn would agree to just pay the town the tens of millions of dollars per year until I think it's 2049 when the town would break even. But I don't know how that resolves. It's possible it resolves in litigation.
I mean, this really feels like a monorail Music Man story or a Donald Trump casino, like a classic version of a con. And now everyone's gonna be left picking up the pieces and nothing really good is gonna come out of it. And a lot of the costs are sunk and there'll be no accountability. And I guess, like, what's the lesson here?
Yeah, I think one of the really striking things to me about this whole fiasco is how clear it was from the beginning that it was not going to end well. There was a real lack of due diligence on the part of the architects of the deal in terms of just sort of assessing the likelihood that this would ever happen. Even after the deal was signed and the project started moving, there were other signs, like when Foxconn shrunk the factory to 1/20th of the size. And kind of despite that, no one was really willing to hit pause and reassess the situation. You still had the town, threatening residents with eminent domain and relocating people. The state was still building infrastructure. And defenders of the deal, Walker, Republicans in the state assembly, continued to say, this is on track. They're going to employ 13,000 people. It's all going well. And I think that insistence that what was evidently the case was not happening did cause this project to do a lot more damage than sort of your standard economic development projects that fall short.
I mean, I guess the question is, like, does anyone ever try anything like this again?
I think there's been a souring on these sorts of projects. I think you even saw that sort of with Amazon, which happened shortly afterward with Amazon in New York. No one on either side of the political spectrum should really like this kind of economic development, this targeted economic development. It's not, as you mentioned, it's not very amenable to free market ideas. It's also, from the left, not really a good use of public funds if what you're after is well-paying jobs and family-sustaining wages, something that the Wisconsin officials talk a lot about. There are other ways to do that, other sort of broader policies that you can institute that are better for a variety of businesses or local businesses rather than paying lots and lots of money to a company to come in
right
and build something that, in this case, did not happen.
Yeah. What does Walker say about it? I mean, obviously he lost, and he's just like a guy who tweets now, but does he still say, like, yep, still it's going to happen, guys. Don't you worry. Great deal.
he was defending the project for a while after he left office, but he's been pretty quiet on it. He didn't respond to my request for comment, and I haven't heard him say anything lately. I think, even among the Republicans who still hold office in the state, there's been silence lately.
I wonder also, has the White House talked about it? Has Donald Trump? I mean, obviously it was like a big thing, the golden shovel and the whole, this obviously is part of the Trump MO, but, big splashy groundbreakings followed by broken promises.
He has continued to talk about it sort of right up to the end of the election. He mentioned it at a rally in Wisconsin. He gave an interview to a local TV station where he talked about, he said Foxconn had built an amazing factory in Wisconsin.
Wait, he said
and
that?
He did say that, paraphrasing, but something about how Foxconn had built, the greatest thing he'd ever seen. And that, Foxconn might not want to do business in states run by Democrats, but if he's reelected, they'll bring even more money and they'll invest more than any company has ever invested before.
Oh, so while everyone in Wisconsin essentially just kind of like embarrassingly walked away from it, like Trump just kept pretending that it had happened and been good.
Yes. Yeah.
That's really amazing.
And you had other sort of moments of involvement from the White House. Navarro periodically would defend the deal and say it hadn't fallen short. He actually met with some Foxconn people during a sort of ill-fated plan, one of Foxconn's many ill-fated attempts to make money, in which, you know, he instructed them to become suppliers to the General Services Administration. That went nowhere, but the White House has continued to sort of say, you know, this has gone well.
And what, I guess the place to end is like, what about the people? Do people still work in that? Do they still go to work every day in that downtown Milwaukee office building that they bought and watched Game of Thrones?
Some do. There were layoffs sort of at the beginning of this year, kind of right after the subsidy deadline passed. So a lot of people got let go. Foxconn has sort of that final subsidy push. It started employing some really dubious tactics. It started targeting foreign students on visas because they said they would work longer hours for cheaper. It still employs some people. It started manufacturing servers, like a pretty small operation, you know, a couple dozen people maybe. It said it's going to make ventilators for COVID,
I'm sure that'll
but
happen.
No one knows whether any ventilators have been made. So people are still working there. You know, everyone I talked to, they had left or were looking to leave.
Really wild. Josh Sheza is investigations editor and feature writer at The Verge, covering technology, business, and climate change. He's got an article about what became of the Foxconn myth in the state of Wisconsin. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Once again, great thanks to Josh Sheza, who's the investigations editor, feature writer at The Verge, covering technology, business, and climate change. His piece is called The Eighth Wonder of the World, Wonder Not Guaranteed, and you can check that out online. We'd love to hear your feedback. Tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team and Kate Shaw, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/whyisthishappening.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.